Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Dr. Rhys Macold, lecturer at the University of Glasgow, joins me to break down the myth of Israel's Iron Dome defense system, its efficacy, its roots in the U.S. military-industrial complex, and how it inflates the danger of Hamas's projectiles.
And Heather Digby-Parton will help me run down the biggest news stories of the week. Hey, you can help support this show by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you not only support this show, but you also get more of the show. This week, I'll be talking to Eric Cortalesa. He is an investigative reporter with Washington Monthly, about the burgeoning antitrust movement on the left, some hint of it on the right, which has scared some of the more mainstream conservatives out there, and they have formed a group to push back on any chance of antitrust progress in this Biden administration. So check it out by becoming a member today, ROFpodcast.com. Again, we cannot do this show without our members supporting it, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon and, of course, her very popular blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we have been saying for quite some time that the proof in the pudding, and I know there's different ways that people say that, apparently, proof is in the tasting of the pudding, et cetera, that the real test for the Biden administration was going to come in the second 100 days of his administration. And we are in that second 100 days. I would say that we are more than halfway through that second 100 days, I think, at this point. Can't do the math off the top of my head. But we are starting to get a better, clearer picture of what is going to be possible with the Biden administration and the Democrats in the Senate as constructed. And it doesn't look too good at this point, does it?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you know, and you and I have been talking about this from the beginning. We knew that the first 100 days, the right wing and the Republicans would be still sort of discombobulated. We were in the midst of the, you know, the terrible winter surge that was still going on, and that Biden would probably have some early success, which he did with the COVID relief package. And so we knew that it was going to be the second 100 days, as you said. And what we also knew was that there were some serious roadblocks that were awaiting the Democrats. And we kept thinking and hoping and kind of wishing that they had a plan to get over those roadblocks, because they were there from the beginning and we knew it. I mean, it's a fifth, and it's the Senate. I mean, the House has its own issues, but they do have a majority, and the Democrats, you know, are voting together. I mean, there's not, you know, there's not a faction of blue dogs that's, you know, ranting and raving and holding up legislation. The House is holding together, but the Senate, we always knew that there was, you know, Joe Manchin, of course, and Kyrsten Sinema, and probably a whole bunch of others in there who weren't so willing to come out and take the heat. And, you know, this, it's a 50-50 Senate. And, you know, that means that even if you get rid of the filibuster, you still may not be able to get over 50 votes. And I talked about this a couple of weeks ago here, about the history of this going back, you know, decades of, there's always a few centrist Democrats. There's a structural issue with that because they often come from conservative states. And they're always kind of using that as an excuse in many ways to do the bidding of their rich donors who, you know, they say, hey, my voters, what can I do? You know, they're all a bunch of rural farmers and I got to do this, that, and the other. So, you know, this is a structural dynamic that has been with us for a long time. And it's particularly acute right now because it really rests around a handful of senators. And we knew that was going to happen. And so here we are in the second 100 days. Last weekend, Joe Manchin came out. He wrote an ungrammatical op-ed in his local newspaper. And he basically said, and I, you know, people keep saying, well, maybe he didn't really mean it. And I'm going, you know what, at this point, I think we have to assume that Joe Manchin is not saying these things for no reason. He came out and said he would not vote for S1, HR1, the For the People Act, which was the big, you know, sort of omnibus voting rights bill that had passed the House. And he also said clearly, and in my mind, without equivocation, that he would not vote to, quote, weaken the filibuster. Now, people are saying, well, maybe he, you know, maybe you can see he'll go along with reform if it's not weakening it or whatever. Well, this has been going on for months now. And, you know, maybe, you know, there's still, I see it on TV all day long. Well, the Democrats just need to show Joe Manchin that the Republicans won't work in a bipartisan basis. Well, they did with the January 6th commission, right. The one that is so glaringly, obviously called for a bipartisan vote. Nothing could be, even Mitch McConnell, the day after the insurrection, was out there, you know, railing against it. If they couldn't get a bipartisan vote on that, which had no effect on donors or money or anything else, they're not going to get a bipartisan vote on some complicated piece of legislation. Right. So in my view, here we are. And I think, and I hate to say this, the grand agenda that everybody wanted with the big spending on all the infrastructure, all the social improvements, all of that, I think is dead. I hope I'm wrong, but I honestly do not see a way out.
All right. A lot to discuss there. And I want to table for just the moment the question of a reconciliation bill on an infrastructure, because that's the one that everybody sort of felt was already in their back pocket on mm-hmm. some level, right? I mean, it was just a question of what the number was going to be. But before we get there, let's spread this sort of depressing analysis out if we can. One thing that I know that you and I talked about at the very least last week, but it was starting to become more become clearer a couple of weeks ago. And even, you know, Joe Manchin had signaled this not as strongly, but really a couple of months ago that he wasn't interested in S1, HR1,
right,
or the People Act. He was open to the John Lewis Voting Act, which is essentially a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. However, you know, and we should go into that a little bit because it's not quite so simple. But he said he was interested in that, and we had speculated that, well, maybe part of the reason why is because there's the For the People Act has to do with good government and has to do with anti-corruption measures and things like, you know, disclosure on money and campaign finance reform, et cetera, et cetera. And AOC, who I think is also probably, you know, she may have come to the same conclusion that you have on some level, maybe, and that I have, which is that this is over. And now it's a question of, like, you know, how is the blame going to be distributed? Who is going to make a political message out of this? And how can you salvage 2022 in this, you know, both those first two questions are associated with the latter. And she said, look, you know, there's absolutely no reason to think that Joe Manchin won't vote on this because of partisan reasons. He's voted for other things that were, you know, the impeachment of a president, for one, or the, let's say, the, for instance, the COVID relief bill that was all passed by Democrats. I mean, so the idea that, it's a partisan issue for him on that, and seems to be sort of hedging on the John Lewis thing. Like, we got to get Lisa Murkowski may vote for it, and therefore it would be a bipartisan vote. But of course, you still need to fix the filibuster in some measure for that. But we should also say about the John Lewis voting rights authorization is that my understanding is that the requirements for that bill, they need to have public hearings, and that won't it appears that that won't be able to pass until well into the fall, and it is not retroactive. So all of these changes that these the states have made that are so detrimental to people's opportunity to vote in these states would remain in effect and would be essentially grandfathered in, which is also just sort of a real bastardization of what the point of the Voting Rights Act was, right? It was like,
yeah,
the Voting Rights Act was passed to deal with what our grandfathers had done, just to carry through the metaphor, not to excuse and allow to remain in place what our grandfathers had done,
right,
so to speak. I mean, I think probably at around the time of the Voting Rights Act, it wasn't just our grandfathers, and it wasn't even just our fathers. It was our right. brothers and maybe even our sons,
exactly.
you know, just to carry through the metaphor. But so, I mean, I think it is, you know, people are starting to call him out, Manchin out. Mitch McConnell doesn't feel that Joe Manchin is going to switch parties. I don't know if that is, you know, it's hard to know if that's not a tactical response by Mitch McConnell. I think Mitch McConnell probably doesn't care. He doesn't need. Why does he need Mitch? I mean, from Mitch McConnell's perspective, Joe Manchin's doing exactly what you would want him to do.
Exactly. Yeah.
And now Mitch McConnell could still be in the opposition. He doesn't have to worry about being charged with obstruction because it's all happening from Joe Manchin, as far as mm-hmm. everybody's concerned. I mean, Joe Manchin seems to be working for about, you know, three quarters of the Senate, it seems like, right? They're all hiding behind Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin also, like I said, voted for impeachment. So maybe he's a little worried about running in a Republican primary. Maybe he doesn't even want to be a senator after this. Who knows? But there doesn't seem to be any way to reach Joe Manchin. And look, Joe Biden made some promises that were very broad promises, and they weren't crazy left wing promises. They were promises about his skill set. And the Democratic Party, the party apparatus, and frankly, the base probably, all voted based upon that promise, which was, I'm a steady hand. I can bring us back to normal. I'll be the one to shake the Republicans out of their stupor, their post-Trump stupor. And he can't even get the 50th vote of his own party at this point. And, you know, like I say, I think there's a lot of people hiding behind Joe Manchin, but you can't see them until Joe Manchin gets out of the way.
Exactly.
But and we should say this is not the issue with people hiding behind Joe Manchin. It's not merely simply cosmetic. That means that there's probably five or six people in the Senate, Democrats. Maybe there's more. Maybe there's eight or nine who are going to Joe Manchin and go, we got your back. I can't come out and say it. You know that. But whatever you need, like there is a competing set of incentivizers within the Democratic Party who are counterbalancing what Joe Biden's doing. Mm-hmm. In other words, for all we know, there are members of the party, you know, people say, well, you should earmark for Joe Manchin, you know, let's say the Joe Manchin Civic Center in West Virginia. Well, we don't know that there aren't Democratic senators who are chairing committees or, you know, have leadership on committees who aren't going to Joe and go like, don't worry, you're going to get that civic center, particularly if you don't crash the filibuster. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, you know, and it would be, it's not hard to imagine that that's going on at this point, right? I mean, Joe Biden seems to have absolutely no arrows in his quiver because presumably he's called up Manchin and said, what do you want?
Yeah.
Manchin says, like, there's nothing that you can give me that I can't get from somebody else and maintain my brand.
Well, I think we know that he did that. I mean, he sat there and we've talked about this, negotiated for weeks with Shelley Moore Capito, the other West Virginia. I mean, you know, she gets to take credit for the for the Joe Manchin, Shelley Moore, Capito Recreation Center too, right? So, I mean, all of that, we talked about that. She was sort of serving as a proxy in many ways for what can we give Joe Manchin to make this thing happen. And that fell apart. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, I'm glad it did, because that was, you know, a very bad deal that those Republicans were pushing. The new bipartisan deal Mitt Romney and Kirsten Sinema's there and Manchin's there and a bunch, you know, yeah. I mean, they've got the whole crew of, you know, mushy middle, you know, so-called centrists in the Senate, which they aren't. They're all conservatives. But, you know, they're doing a bill. And in fact, I read something today in the Washington Examiner that I thought was very interesting. The Republicans are watching that negotiation going on, and they're actually afraid they're going to come up with something they can call bipartisan, because they think that, you know, those senators who they consider to be apostates and, you know, anti-Trump or whatever, that they'll give that to Biden, which will give him a win. And then the Democrats, Schumer, is planning to take the rest of the agenda that was left off that bipartisan bill and push that through reconciliation. And they think that's the sneaky end run that the Democrats are going to do. Now, if they really were going to do that, I'd say, hey, good for them. Smart move. Very canny politics. But
let me just be clear on what you're saying for folks. We are talking about the infrastructure bill. Now.
Correct.
And
yes.
We are talking about what started out with Joe Biden coming out. I have a $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill. And we should say this is the first tranche of that, right? There was a second tranche that was more, you know, about actually like providing things like paid parental leave and a whole host of things that will make your life easier. And now we're not even, that's like a balloon filled with helium, and we can now, it's been let go in the air. We can barely see that going away. We're just talking about the more hard infrastructure, although there is or was at the beginning $400 billion for elder care, which apparently we don't need anymore because no one's getting older. All right. Well, let's take a break. And then when we come back, let's walk through these different scenarios, because this is, you know, our fantasy life has gotten very, very banal and and sadly has become very limited. When we return, we will talk about this new sort of downsized fantasy infrastructure bill. We'll be right back after this. So, Heather, at the break, we had switched to talking about having given up on the idea that there's going to be any type of filibuster reform that has implications in terms of voting right, fixing the Voting Rights Act, et cetera, that we are left with two bites at the reconciliation apple, according to the parliamentarian, who apparently under a Democratic Senate is a sacrosanct position and cannot be removed, despite the fact that you and I both watched it happen when the Republicans didn't like what the parliamentarian said 20 years ago during the George W. Bush era. The parliamentarian says we have two more reconciliations. Some people think that the second reconciliation, which would have to happen after April 2022, because of the essentially, it's not quite the fiscal year, but the budget year, the reconciliation year, if you will, is so close to the election that we won't see anything. I'm not so sure about that, but let's put that in, you know, on the table. Turning back to the infrastructure bill, you were talking about Biden having said, well, Shelley and Capito, we can't come to a deal. And I'm going to immediately pivot to now like a gang of, and all right, answer this question for me. I know Romney's there. I know Murkowski's probably there. Maybe Collins, Kennedy,
maybe Portman, Cassidy. He's on
Cassidy.
There.
Excuse me, Cassidy. I don't know if Kennedy is there. How big is this gang?
Because it's not big enough.
It has to be a gang of 20.
Yeah.
Right? Because we need 10 Republicans in addition to the 10 Democrats. So I don't even understand the theory behind this. All right. So walk me through. You said that Republicans had some fear. I'm not sure I understand what the fear is in this instance. Well, go ahead.
The fear is ridiculous, but this is what they're putting out there. For whatever reason, they decided to tell somebody in the, you know, some source in the, and they said it was a Republican lawmaker. So it was somebody in the caucus saying that they feared that this bipartisan group was going to come up with an agreeable package to the group, right? Okay, and so that they would pass it.
We've got
to
deal. But wait, but how does the pass it part
That's it.
Work?
Well, there are two parts. The first is, I don't know how you get that passed. I do not think Mitch is going to go along with any bipartisan deal on spending like that. I just don't see it. I don't see anything, even though the infrastructure is good for the individual senators. There's lots of them who would benefit by it. There are people, we all know that building bridges and roads and every schools and whatever is, you know, good for business. They're not going to do it because they're looking at 2022 and they want to say it's a failed presidency. It's a do nothing Congress. They can't get anything done. And that's how they're going to run. We know this. This is not brain surgery. OK, but this person was expressing concern that somehow or another they might pull it off and get 10. Maybe there's some people on the edges going, well, maybe we should do it. I don't know. But it's the second part that's really ridiculous, because they're saying that then they're going to pull all this stuff together that was taken out of the original of the bill, and probably including that second tranche, I would assume, along with whatever, of the infrastructure spending that was left in when Biden lowered his ante. And they're going to pass that through reconciliation. And I'm going, have you heard of Joe Manchin? Do you know him? Because he's a guy who's saying he doesn't want, you know, I don't think he's a 50th vote for the bigger reconciliation bill.
Reconciliation.
This is why I'm so pessimistic, because what Joe Manchin is saying, and this, it's really important to listen to him, because he's saying something very specific. It's not about the bills themselves. It's not about the substance of what they're trying to pass. It's a process thing. His entire philosophy around this whole Congress is that it's his job to bring back bipartisanship and make sure that we don't create any more divisions. Therefore, if something gets bipartisan buy-in from Republicans, even though it's filibustered, even though it cannot pass, he considers that a success because it was bipartisan. That is his goal, is to get Republicans on board, some Democratic initiatives, even though it's not enough, so that he can claim, hey, look, it was bipartisan. There were people, those darned Republicans, you know, look at them. They just want that Mitch McConnell is just being political here. This was a bipartisan bill. I worked for it. Look, West Virginia, look at me. Look at how great I am. Everything he says, like his op-ed, it seemed to me that was just very glaringly clear that it's about the process for him. This is what it is. So I don't think I honestly don't think he cares about the outcome. He may have cared about the COVID relief bill because.
Well, Jim Justice, his own governor, was
right.
was to the left of him on that.
We were in a catastrophic emergency. I mean, those are the kinds of things that you can even usually get Republicans on board with. Didn't this time, but usually you can.
Jim Justice, Republican governor in West Virginia, was saying, you know, cut the $2,000 checks.
Get it.
And so, Joe Manchin had plenty of space there. And I want to just piggyback on what you're saying. So the people understand that, because there's a lot of people who are listening to this and going, well, that process thing, that's insane.
That's
full on insane. And I'm of the opinion that Joe Manchin is not insane. I am of the opinion that Joe Manchin is craven. And the analogy would be this. I challenge I don't know anybody to a basketball game, someone who I'm actually afraid, or maybe someone challenges me to a basketball game, someone who I'm afraid that I'm going to lose to. And I say, well, I am happy to play you. I only, however, recognize slam dunks. If there's not slam dunks, then if we can't do slam dunks, then I don't want to play because that's not really basketball to me. and however, I'm not able to slam dunk right now because of a knee strain. And so therefore I can't play because it's not that I'm afraid of playing you. I only play with slam dunks and I can't slam dunk right now. So we can't play. And otherwise I would play. I'm interested in playing, but I'm only interested in slam dunking. And
that's absolutely right. And you have to look at his motivation here too. And this is important. There's been a lot of discussion this week, but this has been going on for months. Jane Mayer wrote a piece in the New Yorker last March about the intense pressure coming from the Koch network on all the senators, Democratic and Republican, not to pass this agenda, starting with HR 1, but going through all of it. They do not want any of it passed. And I encourage people to read this piece in the New Yorker by Jane Mayer. And there's a lot of stuff that's come out this week as well. CNBC wrote a big piece on it. There is intense pressure coming from that big money portion of the donor base of both parties. And in fact, in Mayer's piece, she said specifically, we're having that the Koch people, I don't know, it was Americans for Prosperity or one of their groups, we're having a lot of fun with Joe Manchin. So let's not kid ourselves that there isn't, you know, another countervailing pressure coming from that sector, which I think in the case when you said Craven, Joe Manchin, I think that's what we're talking about. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's Heritage. Yeah. It's all these groups and he answers to those. That's his, you know, West Virginia, you know, so, you know, where it's not just about, you know, some kind of ideological split or anything there. There's this other thing that's going on. And until we deal with that, which, by the way, HR 1 goes at that. They do
absolutely,
not want that.
Absolutely. 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 And then this is, you know, I mean, this is really poor. I wish I knew how people were supposed to react with this knowledge, but it's important for them to know. I mean, so often, I do believe that there are some sincere institutionalists, you know, who have been in the Senate over the years. The ones who are still talking about the Senate as an institution and about process are not those people. Even the most sincere of the institutionalists, Russ Feingold was one of those people,
right,
back in the day. And there's others who were sincere institutionalists. They've all come around to seeing, like, look, there's the institution but if there's not another entity in there. And so when you hear people talk about bipartisanship and in this era, it is essentially a fig leaf, mm-hmm, for corporate water carrying, you know, doing their bidding, whatever it is. I mean, that's basically what's going on here. And I mean, the real question is, we've got just about a minute left. It's like, you know, how does this impact 2022? Or what does Joe Biden do? At one point does he say, okay, I know the downstream implications of $50,000 debt relief for student debt. It's not going to be as targeted in the same way that I wanted before, but I mean, there's plenty of data. I've interviewed people on this program about the Brookings Institute coming out with data showing, like, all the implications of what this debt relief would do in terms of helping the country, not just the, mm-hmm, individuals, but the country, right, itself. I mean, with 30 seconds left, does he pivot to that? Does Joe Biden pivot to doing it unilaterally, or does he just get up there and say, like, hey, it's not my fault, man. No joke.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know. I mean, what I do know is that he and Joe Manchin have a similar sort of shtick that they're using. We want to save the soul of America. Biden thinks it's bipartisanship out in the country. Manchin thinks it's bipartisanship in the U.S. Congress. And I don't think either one of those things have anything. I don't think saving the soul of the country has anything to do with bipartisanship. And I think that maybe Joe Biden's going to have to jettison that particular idea if he wants to save the soul of America. I mean, you know, if
indeed
he wants to do that.
Heather Parton, always a pleasure. We will see you next week.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Israel's defense system, the Iron Dome, has been in the news more than usual lately after the latest act of aggression by Israel led to Palestinian retaliation and then mass death disproportionately on the Palestinian side. But is the Iron Dome simply a defense system as it's often described, or is it more than that? Is it a symptom of the larger politics of domination in Israel's treatment of Palestine? Here to explore this is Dr. Reese Mackold, lecturer in international relations for the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Glasgow. His piece on this topic in Jacobin is entitled "The Iron Dome System is a Monument to Israel's Hubris." Welcome to the show, Reese.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's first explain to the audience what the Iron Dome is, what its function is, how it came to be, et cetera, and then we'll dive into the specifics of what you wrote about.
Sure. So, I mean, in broad strokes, the Iron Dome system is sort of lauded as an anti-missile shield that is supposed to protect Israel and Israelis from so-called Hamas rockets and other projectiles from other foreign states. For example, in Lebanon and so on. It's primarily been operationalized in relation to Gaza, where projectiles from Hamas come out of, often in retaliation for various forms of Israeli aggression. Just sort of as a broad background, the system was sort of operationalized in 2011, and it's been used in a number of different military assaults since on Gaza, and has generally been sort of celebrated as a success story, both by Israeli officials, media pundits, and foreign state leaders, who often praise it as being sort of 90% successful in intercepting so-called Hamas rockets, and claiming that the system has basically saved a lot of Israeli. But yeah, so since around 2012, those figures, particularly the 90% interception rate, have been vigorously contested by a range of critics. These included kind of Israeli defense scientists, weapons experts, and so on, as well as some other experts and critics and scholars from outside of Israel. And they've in various ways sort of poked holes in the 90% success rate figure on a number of grounds that we can get into in detail if you'd like.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd love to flesh out for the audience a little bit of how the Iron Dome became this behemoth and I think significant piece of conversation surrounding this conflict and the apartheid in Israel, right? I mean, 2011 is when it was really first deployed, as you say, but it's now become so central to the conversation. So if you could just talk about its growth and how the conversation around it has progressed to the point 10 years later where we're talking about the Iron Dome as so integral to Israel's maintained stature in the region.
Sure. So, I mean, I think it's sort of audiences would probably find it useful to sort of situate Iron Dome in a bit of a broader context. So it's both in the context of Israel as a settler colonial state, but also sort of histories of missile defense more broadly. As some of your audience members may know, histories of missile defense date back quite a bit, at least to the Cold War, and have been broadly considered sort of recurring failures in terms of their inability to actually intercept projectiles. So again, like I said, this dates back to the Cold War. But Iron Dome has been broadly seen as a kind of exception to the rule. So in short, whereas other forms of missile defense programs by the United States in previous decades, for example, have been sort of radically debunked in various ways over the years, Iron Dome is sort of held up as an exception to the rule in the sense that it's the first time any state has developed a missile defense program that's highly successful as opposed to missile defense systems in general. And sort of in the history of Israel itself, again, Iron Dome is sort of seen as sort of an exponent of Israeli exceptionalism, which fits within a kind of broader history of Israel as a sort of self-proclaimed exceptional country that is both capable of exceptional feats of military prowess, but also an exceptional country in the sense of saving life and doing things that Israel claims to do, which are highly questionable. But that's been sort of the ways in which the Iron Dome system has become kind of a stand-in for Israeli exceptionality, particularly in the realm of sort of defense and security, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think you said it really well. A stand-in for Israeli exceptionalism is a really it's a really great way to put it. And when you see yourself as exceptional, I think it, much like American exceptionalism and colonialism, you are able to give yourself a lot more leeway in terms of the atrocities that you may commit. So let's actually talk about the efficacy or purported efficacy of the Iron Dome. As you write, much of the media's coverage of the Iron Dome is positive in that it protects Israeli lives. It's consistently what we're told. But there have been independent analyses and, I guess, just observations by people, including an MIT researcher that you cite, that question the efficacy of the dome itself, and then that brings us to, if the dome's efficacy is inflated, are Hamas's rockets or projectiles also inflated in terms of their danger? I would say the answer is yes, but would love to hear your thoughts on the matter that you write about so well in your piece.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, just before I get started, I want to kind of clarify that, you know, I'm a social scientist and certainly not a physicist or a rocket scientist. So I'm relying here on kind of the research of others, which I find to be quite credible. And basically, I think it's important to also note just from the outset that because the Israeli military and the Israeli state has never disclosed any sort of reliable data about Iron Dome's alleged 90% success rates or any information at all, really, the only real information that we have on its success rates are based on other independent researchers and experts who've tried to make sense of the system in action. And this data is derived from a range of sources, including video of the contrails of Iron Dome interception missiles, which you can basically, through video analysis, see how they are working or not working. And so within that realm, there's some degree of ambiguity about, you know, which experts we would prefer to trust and which are more or less credible. But in broad strokes, as you mentioned, there's been a number of what I would say highly credible researchers, including some MIT scientists, as well as quite prominent critics of the Israeli state, including Norm Finkelstein and others, who've used various forms of data to poke holes in the idea that these Iron Dome interception missiles, in fact, do collide with Hamas projectiles in such a way that they would actually destroy them. And so over the years, they have basically in various ways contested the extent to which the Iron Dome does in fact collide with Hamas projectiles and the extent to which those collisions do in fact disarm those projectiles and make them incapable of inflicting damage. And so through those various forms of data, while the different estimates vary considerably, some estimates have, you know, placed Iron Dome success rate around close to zero, and some of them are considerably higher. But in broad strokes, the information that the Israeli state have supplied to the media and to publics, I would say simply doesn't add up. And I think what's more telling, perhaps even than the statements that are questionable, is, as I sort of articulated the piece, when Israeli officials have been pressed by critics to explain Iron Dome success rates and supply data, in broad strokes, their response has been simply to deny any information and simply asserted success. So I think the rebuttals of the critics are also highly telling in terms of showing kind of the holes in the narrative about its purported exceptionality.
So the 90% figure, where is that like, where does that come from? Is it just kind of taken from the Israeli government and then regurgitated? Because I've heard it consistently in U.S. media, which is a journalism no-no. And also, I mean, how does this play into the inflation of the efficacy of Hamas's rockets or projectiles, as you say, because they are not guided. They are sometimes described as just some more powerful fireworks. And of course, they can create shrapnel and they can kill people and they have killed people. But in terms of describing them as rockets, that seems like a little bit of a stretch. If you could just touch on those two things.
Sure. I mean, so the 90% success rate is highly significant. And I'm glad you raised it because it's circulation and it's sort of seeming unassailability is, I think, highly notable from a journalism perspective, as you sort of allude to. Basically, that figure is straight out of the mouth of, you know, Israeli press officials, military officials, and so on. In the piece, you might also note that recently they have claimed it to be, some officials in the recent assault have claimed it to be up to 95%, but 90% seems to be their favorite number. That number is, from what I gather, basically just out of nowhere. I think it's a rather convenient number in the sense that it allows for some deaths of people within Israel's official 1948 borders to be killed with those. So it doesn't, it makes possible an accounting of some of the deaths of Israelis killed by Hamas projectiles. But beyond that, I don't think it has any meaning as a kind of scientific figure. And like I said, the critics that I have charted in the piece and some other work that I've been doing, there's not a single credible expert that I've been able to find who confirmed anything close to 90% success rate.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will dive further into this discussion. And we're going to talk about the Iron Dome's connection to the United States-based military-industrial complex and how that kind of feeds itself. We'll be right back. So before we broke, we were talking about the lack of clarity around the actual efficacy of the Iron Dome system in Israel. And I just wanted to clarify this for the audience because when we're talking about Hamas's rockets, right, it's so casually thrown around in U.S. media where it's like Israel has rockets and Hamas has rockets. And what do you know? There's just this equal conflict between these two parties going back and forth. Israel's rockets are incredibly sophisticated. Hamas's projectiles can barely be called rockets. So can you just emphasize for the audience how disparate those two weapons are?
Yeah, so I mean, as I note in the piece, I think one of the most important, although in some ways there are certain aspects of Iron Dome that are highly confusing and mystifying and hard to kind of put your finger on what exactly is happening. But in broad strokes, sort of what the system does politically and ideologically, I think are quite obvious. And one of the most important things that I note in the piece is that I think the system kind of reinscribes this imaginary of a kind of two-sided symmetrical conflict between Israel and Hamas. And if you read kind of mainstream news organizations, sort of coverage of the recent assault, you'll often hear it framed as the Israel-Hamas conflict, as though there's a sort of symmetrical, equally sided conflict. And so because it purports to sort of maintain the terms of that conflict, it sort of fits into a sort of broader ideological struggle over the way we imagine the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis as being somehow this sort of longstanding conflict between two opposing sides, which, I mean, as many Palestinian scholars have argued for many decades, is highly misleading in any number of ways. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think the portrayal of that weaponry as I think equivalent is part of that as well. So let's dive into its ties to U.S. funding and U.S. Defense contractors like Raytheon. How much is understanding that connection integral to understanding the relationships and power dynamics at play here.
Yeah, so I mean, it's absolutely crucial. And I think here, Iron Dome is highly illuminating of the ways in which sort of Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid are connected with U.S. empire, and the ways in which those forms, as you mentioned, as American exceptionalism, the ways in which Israeli exceptionalism and American exceptionalism kind of reverberate with each other and are sort of co-constituted with one another over many decades. In broad strokes, there's simply no way Iron Dome would have ever existed without U.S. military funding. The U.S. has picked up the bill for almost all of Iron Dome's cost in terms of R&D, but also operational costs. And as we saw in relation to the last assault, Joe Biden swiftly pledged his support to renew all the Iron Dome batteries and pledge more support to Israel in the future. And the U.S., from figures that I've been able to find, has put in about $1.5 billion into Iron Dome since 2011, and on an annual basis provides Israel with, you know, upwards sort of in the high $3.8 or so billion dollars a year or somewhere around there. And so Iron Dome in some way just part of that broader picture. It's nothing particularly special. However, it gives that whole arrangement the idea of somehow doing something that's very essential and saving Israeli lives and doing something highly pathbreaking in sort of technological terms. So in many ways, sort of the Iron Dome kind of provides a kind of facade to justify U.S. funding of Israeli aggression against Palestinians under the pretense of kind of innovation or life-saving in this kind of outrageous reframing of what's actually happening.
Well, I mean, can you expand upon that? Because I think that's such a salient point about the technology element of it, right? It's a way to view war. And we saw a lot of this with drones in the United States and the conversation around it as some sort of technological innovation akin to us taking the next step in humanity, when it's really just kind of sanitizing the most brutal aspects of our humanity. Is this a larger trend that you're seeing? I know this is a bit of a left turn, but in warfare and in the way that people want to look about warfare and death, am I onto something there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so I think it's, you know, in the sort of contemporary neoliberal world that we live in, we're often hearing sort of references to sort of sanitized forms of warfare or drone warfare that allegedly is somehow very precise and doesn't kill civilians and so on. Of course, Israel is well known as a kind of leader in this field of allegedly precision guided warfare, in part by its operations against Hamas leaders in Gaza, for example. But I think it's also important to just realize how much sort of political and ideological weight the term kind of innovation carries. And another sort of common sort of association with the state of Israel is the so-called Startup Nation, which is a famous popular book about sort of Israeli startup culture and Israeli so-called technological innovation prowess. And so Iron Dome is kind of like a shorthand for that broader story of Israel as this sort of exceptional high-tech country with these exceptional skills and abilities. And I think while there are some elements of truth in that story, in the sense that, you know, Israel does have a significant high-tech industry, for example, the idea of sort of violence, as you noted, as a form of innovation or progress or even life-saving activities is obviously highly misleading. But I think also Iron Dome kind of illuminates the sort of how empty and sort of brittle that picture is when we sort of poke at it a little bit, in the sense that I think it's quite interesting and maybe even surprising that the Israeli state wants to stake its entire sort of public image on a system that by all accounts does not do what it says it does. So I think there's kind of an interesting story in there, both about kind of the power of that image and the weight that it commands in the world today, but also kind of the limits of it and what it kind of speaks to in terms of maybe the fragilities of the Israeli project or kind of the settler colonial formation that it embodies.
Right. I mean, and the thing about it is that there's very, I mean, at least in the United States, very little conversation surrounding what is perceived as fact. So the Iron Dome is 90% effective, and the Hamas is a terrorist organization, and it is violent, and you know, no discussion about the terroristic acts committed by Israel, which is quite literal when you're targeting schools and COVID testing centers and healthcare facilities. I mean, if this was done by Hamas, it would be terrorism, 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 terrorism. And that brings me, I guess, to a bit of a broader question, which you do talk about in your piece, is how the Iron Dome is a system that seems to kind of reproduce, as you write, anxieties of Israelis about Hamas, and which is constantly conflated with Palestinians in general, while also managing that anxiety. I thought that was so well said. Can you just expand upon that a little bit for our audience?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, if we sort of can take for granted, based on what I've said, that, you know, Iron Dome is not what it seems, of course, that's not to say that sort of the anxieties and fear that Jewish Israelis experience as a result of Hamas projectiles are somehow not real, or moreover, that those projectiles do not sometimes kill real people, which, of course, you know, is a tragedy for their families and loved ones. But I think what I was trying to say in the piece is the fact that the Iron Dome kind of reinscribes the terms of the conflict, as we talked about, but also kind of reproduces the idea of Hamas as kind of the center of threat against the Israeli state and the Zionist sort of conquest and presence on the land. And so as we sort of watch the Iron Dome going off, and it's important to note that in the most recent sort of assault on Gaza, the images of Iron Dome were some of the most widely circulated on social media. People kind of experienced the conflict to some extent from a distance, both Israelis and outsiders from different parts of the world sort of experienced the assault in this kind of mediated way, where they were able to sort of enjoy the idea of Israel saving lives through Iron Dome, whilst also sort of getting to see sort of the alleged threat that Hamas poses to ordinary sort of Jewish citizens of Israel. And so in that sense, I feel it sort of kind of reproduces not just the terms of the conflict, but sort of the anxiety that that Israelis face about this alleged existential threat threatening their ability to stay on the land.
And how much of this heightened threat is inherently racialized? I think we talk a lot about in the United States anti-Semitism, which is a massive problem, I think, domestically, in the rise of white supremacists like Donald Trump, or white supremacist sympathizers, at the very least, he is, and, you know, just these kinds of groups here. It's purposefully conflated with being critical of the right wing imperialism and colonialism that's being perpetuated by Israel. But specifically in this conflict, I mean, there is a racial component that is not talked about. And so you can heighten the threat of Palestinians by saying, you know, brown, predominantly Muslim. I mean, is that something that you think makes the stakes feel higher for spectators in America, whether they be evangelical right wingers or just people around the globe? Is that something that you think adds to this?
Of course. I mean, in your previous question and some of your comments, you sort of mentioned the sort of the idea, or alluded to it, of the sort of Palestinian figure or Hamas as sort of the quintessential terrorist other. And of course, the story of Iron Dome reinscribes that same imaginary. I mean, in the piece, I cite the late Edward Said, you know, the well-known Palestinian scholar, former professor at Columbia, who wrote extensively in a range of writings before his death about kind of the ways in which the so-called Israel-Palestine conflict sort of reinscribes the figure of kind of the racialized Palestinian terrorist other, and many other people have written about that since. But I think it's important to, when you sort of use the word racialized or racialization, there's no dimension of kind of the Zionist conquest of Palestine that began even before 1948 as anything other than a racial project. And there's been a lot of kind of debate recently about, you know, whether or not Israel is an apartheid state within kind of mainstream media. But the question about whether or not the violence that Israelis mete out against Gazans or other Palestinians is somehow racial in character, there's no question about that. And I think, again, Iron Dome kind of plays an important role in kind of both that long history of racialized domination, but also the idea that it's being resolved or mitigated through so-called technical innovation. And just to kind of go back to Saeed for a second as well, I've been doing in some other work, I think it's important to note that these narratives of sort of Israel being kind of a model for the world through its progress is nothing new, even though Iron Dome is in some ways meaningfully new, that sort of the broader narratives that it reinscribes are in no way new. And in some of, you know, Saeed's work in the question of Palestine, for example, he notes that, you know, 10 years after the occupation began in 1967, Israel began taking out sort of op-eds in the New York Times, proclaiming it not as an occupation at all, but rather as kind of a model for living together. And so this, you know, in the piece, what I call, you know, Israeli diaspora or sort of propaganda has a long, long history that is in no way specific to the present. And yet in the present, we find it being kind of rearticulated in relation to particular kinds of technology or particular sort of upticks of violence or in relation to particular events.
This is excellent. Thank you so much. Dr. Rees Mackold, lecturer in international relations for the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Glasgow. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com and hear what you've been missing. You become a member, you're getting our bonus material every week. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, you can check out my daily show, which is co-hosted by my colleague on this program, Emma Vigeland. Every day at noon, we stream live, and then it's later available as a podcast. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire. It's-